Okay. At this time, chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscience meeting. I meet all of those requirements, and every one of them is a miracle. I have over 1 year of continuous sobriety. That's crazy. I remember when I got my 1 year chip, someone said, "Oh, that's a miracle, you know. You have a year of sobriety." And I'm like, "I've had a year of sobriety before." And they're like, "When?" And I'm like, "I was like 16, I think." And they're like, "Yeah, you're not even supposed to be drinking yet." So it kind of gives you some insight into I started hard and I finished hard. And I would have never had a home group because I didn't join anything. Like, I had a fear of commitment to everything. I didn't really want anybody to get to know me because you'd probably hate me. So, like, I'd run with a cross-country team, but I didn't join it. They were like, "Do you want to just join the team?" I'm like, no, I'll just jog along. all my friends were cheerleaders, but, like, I wasn't on the cheerleading team because I was afraid I'd face to stand on these boxes during the game. And I was like, I drank during the game, okay? And I was like, "How do you stand on the boxes?" They're like, "What do you mean?" I'm like, you know, and they were like, "What?" So, anyway, I just, I'm very boozy. And then attend a group conscience meeting, which if you've ever gone to one, the fact that I've gone through one of those sober is a miracle too. And no, it's good though. And today I can take suggestions though, and I appreciate structure, and I appreciate discipline, and all those things that I fought against on the outside when I was Boozy McGee, and now I actually see why it's necessary to keep this going, which is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which saved my life. Because I could not control my drinking. I couldn't stop, and I would have died. I would have either, I don't know if I would have drank myself to death, and I would have been that lucky. I think I would have either jumped out a window or someone would have shot me, because I had a very big mouth when I was drinking, so I still do. But what comes out is much nicer. So anyway, but I'm grateful to be here, so thanks for letting me chair the meeting.
Vanessa.
Thanks, Vanessa. And did that qualify me? Yeah. okay, and the group asked me to remind you to please turn your cell phones off and refrain from moving around or talking while the speaker is sharing. And at this time, I'd like to introduce our speaker, and she's a really good friend of mine, so I'm like nervous for her. And I'm like, God, why did I do this for her? anyway, why did I ask Carla to speak? There's a few reasons. First of all, she's a speaking virgin. I just have to say it. Like, she hasn't told her story yet, and I was just like, forget it. Like, we're at a better place to tell your story than at Central, because it's such a diverse group of people, and there's so many people here, and I just think she has such a great message, so I definitely wanted her to share here. And also, Carla is, I love like a thriller, like that's my genre on Netflix, like the thriller. And Carla is business on the outside, party on the inside. So I love when you see her, you're like, "Hello, everyone," and then you're like, "What?" Like, she's just full of surprises, so I love that. And thirdly is that she is, I think she exemplifies this program. She suits up and she shows up, and a few months ago I went through probably the hardest thing in my sobriety, and the wheels came off. And she was one of my people. She was part of my village. And anyway, really grateful for her. And I think that's enough, because I'm probably going to end up telling her story for her. So anyway, here's Carla. Thanks. Okay, my earring just came off. Sorry. Can I get that? off to a roaring good start. Lost my earring. I brought up speaking points because that always makes me feel a little more confident, and I didn't bring my glasses, and I have nowhere for my water. Hi, I'm Carla. I'm an alcoholic. Can you tell? First of all, Vanessa, thank you very much for asking me to speak tonight. Weirdly enough, I've wanted to do this for a really long time. My sobriety date is April 20th, 2009, and you don't have to be Norman Einstein to realize that's almost 4 years, and it's really been a question in my head. Why aren't they asking me to speak? Because, you know, this is my home group. I come around quite a bit. And one day, actually, someone goes, "Maybe they think you're lame." So, needless to say, I don't know if I'm lame or not, but I'm definitely an alcoholic. And I'm very happy to be here, and I love this group. And
So, yeah, here's my story. I hope that it in any way imparts some wisdom or hope or inspiration to somebody tonight. I was born in Jacksonville, Florida, and don't need to know the year. Use imagination. let's see. My first memory, pretty much, is my parents divorcing when I was three. My mom was an alcoholic. There was some serial infidelity that didn't go over well with my dad. And my dad was pretty much a workaholic who was never around. He was pretty focused on building businesses, and his whole sense of self came from his insane desire to amass wealth. That's what validated him as a person in his mind for reasons that came from his childhood. So my mom had custody of me and my only sibling, who's an older brother. He's 5 years older. And our life changed pretty dramatically at that time. My mom had custody of us, and her drinking went to a whole new level of bad. And she was pretty wild, and she, at the time, probably in her mid to late 30s, and she was hanging out with this guy who was 19, and his family was a junkyard. And he just got back from Vietnam, so he was healthy. And needless to say, there was a lot of drinking and a lot of violence. And I remember I used to make jewelry and curtains and things out of the pop tabs off the Schlitz malt liquor, because back in the olden days, they would come off and you could like curl them and make stuff. It was like Tiffany's in my room. But needless to say, there was a lot of chaos and violence, and I'd go to my dad's house every other weekend, and I really didn't like being there. It wasn't kid-friendly, to say the least. There were no toys. We weren't treated like children. My dad didn't spend any time with us. He took us to his office because he worked 7 days a week, probably 10 hours a day, and he made us work. Like, as soon as we could walk, we had to work, and it was going to make something out of us, and if we didn't work hard enough, unfortunately, he had very, very violent temper, and he had impulses that he could not control, perhaps learned behaviors from his upbringing. But needless to say, between his drinking and the uncontrollable temper and taking it out on animate or inanimate objects around him, kind of took its toll on my brother and I. So I pretty much cowered in fear from him. I didn't want to be around him, and I just used to go to his house, and he'd buy me a new record every weekend that I'd come over, and I'd carry around this little, for those of you who are younger, records are these plastic things, and they can melt, and they're actually coming back in vogue right now. But anyway, so I had this radio player, this whole record player I'd carry around, and I'd have, like, you know, Elton John, Captain Fantastic, that was like one of my favorites. And I'd sit in my room and I would listen to this music over and over and over. And I was already trying to put myself into another world where I could escape my existence. And I then discovered books. You know, once I could read and had music, that was where I was already trying to hide and find solace, just something, so I didn't have to deal with the chaos and the environment. And so my older brother was, you know, 5 years older, and he got more of the physical discipline than I did, just because he's a boy, but also because he got in a lot of trouble. And the trouble really started when he was in seventh grade. He got busted at school for having a half of ounce of, I'm not supposed to talk about other substances, I don't think, but it rhymes with Tijuana, and a scale. So clearly he was already in the distribution business, and that was at seventh grade. So my dad got custody of him, and I was left in my mom's house, and I had no supervision at all. I mean, I knew I was different then, because I went to a private school, and like, my mom was not June Cleaver, but you know, you had all the other moms who were baking cookies and driving carpool and, you know, making little cute sandwiches with no crust, and like, I'd be lucky if I went to 7-Eleven and bought like a rancid 3-day-old squishy sandwich, you know, like, I'd be like, I'm eating, yeah. So I was like, God, why can't I be like my friends? Why can't I have one of those super moms that's like so lovey-lovey, and why can't I have a dad who's not crazy and violent and screaming all the time? And you know, my mom ended up marrying the 19-year-old guy, and that didn't end well. I think the marriage itself lasted for 3 weeks, and the final incident in that was over dinner one night while we're all at the table. He pulled a chandelier out of the ceiling and threw it at her. And yeah, good times, huh? So that was the end of him. But yeah, so like I said, that was normal, you know. So, you know, it was turbulent. And then I just went through a period of my mom looking for another husband and having just, like I said, no supervision. I kind of just ran wild or hung out with my friends. And it kind of went on for a while that way. And then I get older, and my brother's still having all his drug problems, but he's living with my dad. So my dad's trying to deal with him. And about the time he went to college, I started like hanging out with all my brother's friends. They're 5 years older. They like to do the same kind of activities that he did, not healthy. So that was my transition into drinking and intoxicating myself in any way I possibly could. I loved the feeling produced by alcohol. It just made me everything that I wasn't. You know, I was a tomboy. I was told by my mom early on, you're not pretty, so you better develop some other skills. That doesn't bode well, you know. I mean, when you're young, that sticks, because a couple years later, I still remember it pretty clearly. I also had a learning disorder, and there was a lot of cognitive testing that was going on all the time, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. I made really bad grades, but I was really, really intelligent. Like, they're like, oh, she's just undisciplined. But she just can't sit still, and she can't focus. So that also made me feel like I was just a total loser. So when I first took a drink or drug, I was all of a sudden, I felt pretty, I felt cool, I felt I could dance, which is really funny. You know, just all those things. It's like, wow, this is great. And then also, when I knew where every party was, and I knew every source to get anything you wanted, I was like, man, I'm so popular too. Everyone loves me. Mm-hmm. Not knowing that, no, they just want your connections. So as I was going on my first downward spiral, my mom was on her, I guess, third suicide attempt. And this last time she met it, she took a bottle of Valium in front of my brother and I with her scotch. And it was a whole bottle this time. And so no more Dukes of Hazzard that night. And we call the ambulance, and they haul her off, and she was taken away for a while, and I went to live with my dad. And my dad then put all the focus on me that he put onto my brother, and he snatched a knot, to say the least, in my life. All of a sudden, I mean, it wasn't a short leash, it was a harness. Like, I had rules, I had expectations, and there were severe consequences if I didn't live up to them. He was still violent, he was still a megalomaniac. He was still just obsessed with success and all the outward trappings of success. And if you weren't smart, and if you didn't make good grades and go on to make really big money, then you were worthless. Oh, and if you gained weight too and were unhealthy physically, that was also like, oh god, no. So there was a lot of pressure, and he did push me though. And he also at that time hired specialists, educational specialists to work with people that have learning disabilities, because they still hadn't been able to diagnose me with what was wrong, but there was definitely an issue. And so I had a tutor that I had to go and work with every single day, 5 days a week for like 2 hours. And that sucked. I mean, talk about feeling like you're different. You know, gonna get a tutor, you know, and my friends are like, oh, we're gonna go high. Have fun. So yeah. So but something happened. Through that, I started actually making good grades. And my dad started believing in me more and pushing me harder. And by the time I graduated from high school, I actually felt like with the right tools, I can learn and I can retain. And I'm actually not an idiot. That was really cool. So that was just the first little glimmer of hope that I got that I was a worthwhile person. But I was still a binge drinker. I would do any substance that you would put in front of me, because I still loved an altered state of consciousness, but I just tried to do what I could get away with and not get in trouble. There's a part of me that wanted to be a good girl. I really did. So, you know, I ended up going to college in Washington, D.C., and I also did that because Washington, D.C. at the time, this is the 80s, it was the only, well, it's a district, not a state, but their drinking age was 19. everywhere else it was 21, even though I had a really good fake ID too. But yeah, so I went to college in D.C., and that's where my work hard, play hard ethic really, really kicked in full force. I would study, drink. I mean, those that was it. Occasionally eat, sleep a little bit, but, you know, I'd go to class drunk. I didn't care. I'd drink a beer before class sometimes. Didn't matter, but I always went to class. I always worked also. I worked in retail, and I ended up getting a really good job right after I graduated from college. And I never wanted to go back to Jacksonville. I never wanted to be part of my family's businesses. My dad was an inventor, actually, and had a lot of patents. And so we also, his company manufactured the things that he had invented. And, yeah, he was kind of a venture capitalist in the sense that he would invent new things, but he'd have to pay for all of the capitalization himself. He wouldn't take on investors. And then he'd run out of money. Then he's like, oh, shit. Oh, man, I'm broke. Oh, this isn't good. So there's a lot of this, too, financially in my life. And I just, I didn't like that. I wanted stability at some point. So I get a pretty decent job. I'm in D.C. I'm having a good time. And, sorry, thirsty. They've always said I was a thirsty girl. Anyway, I was engaged to a writer, and he then, after we got engaged, he was in Sweden, he wanted me to move to Sweden. I just didn't want to deal with that, so I ended up pulling a geographical, and I left Washington and moved to New York, and that was also really cool, because now I was of age, but you don't drive in New York, so I didn't have to worry about a DUI. That was really cool. And I've always been, you know, really into music. I've mentioned that, so I got a job working for one of the major record labels, and it was actually a lot of work. I thought I was going to be like hanging out with all these rock stars and, you know, it's so fun. You know, didn't work out that way. And the money was horrible, and it's not a real WASPy profession, and that was kind of held against me. I think it was my first, like, reverse discrimination kind of thing. But, yeah, so I did the music industry thing for about 2 years, and then I kind of sold out and went down to Wall Street and started working in operations for a worldwide financial institution, and I did well, but at the same time, I was still partying as hard as I could when I could, and after a couple years of that, and, you know, like I said, I was happy where I was, I was making good money, life was where I wanted it, my dad got cancer, so I moved home and took over the family business. My dad went to the MD Anderson in Houston to get treated, and so I took over the business, didn't want to be there. But I felt it was my obligation as a daughter to do that. And by that point, my dad actually kind of respected me. We had a good relationship, I can't say. And he didn't smack me around anymore either, since I was, you know, pushing 30. still yelled a lot, but, you know, I was safe. But anyway, so we had a really good relationship at this point. And I take over the company, and it really, really grows and grows. And that was also something that took our relationship to another level, is that, you know, we had a really good time working together and growing the company. And my brother ran a division in Dallas, and I met my husband right around the time I'd come back. He lives in Orlando, and needless to say, he's a fourth-generation Orlandoan, if you could, Orlando in a word. But anyway, he wasn't leaving town, you know. He'd gone away to college and came back, and this is it for me. So I really liked Orlando, and so I left Jacksonville and moved here, but I was still running my family's business, kind of going back and forth all the time, and also managing my dad's affairs while he had cancer. So it was pretty stressful. And then in 2002, my husband and I had our first child, a little boy who just is the light of my life. And it was a really scary pregnancy. He was supposed to have all kinds of abnormalities and defects. And I gained 100 pounds, actually. And he came out okay, which was great. And I subsequently lost the weight, which is even just as great. I had some really bad postpartum depression, but, you know, got through that too. And so life was pretty good for a couple years. And then my brother decided that I was too stressed out with the family business. You know, all my, you know, I had a kid, and, you know, I was also volunteering on a lot of local charities boards on an executive level. So he's like, you know, oh, well, her husband's making good money, and she's too busy serving on her boards and being a mom, and, you know, she doesn't really need the money, so why don't you let me run the company now? And so my dad, in a moment of not making a good decision, said, okay. So that was in 2006, and in August of 2007, the company went bankrupt. And in November, you know, 8 weeks later, my dad died. And I was out of a job. I was holding the bag on a lot of corporate debt, and if it was in the millions, that I had co-signed with my dad on. And all of a sudden, you know, having gone from somebody who had a big career, and I was self-sufficient, and I, you know, my husband and I, we had separate assets and you know, all that kind of stuff, I had nothing. And my whole identity was wrapped up in who I was professionally. I kind of felt like that justified, that's what I hid my alcohol behind. That's what made me a valid person, was the fact that I could actually work. I mean, that's the only skill I had, was the ability to work. And all of a sudden, that was gone. And my dad was gone. And he was always my, you know, he'd been my best friend, my supporter, everything. And then when I needed to financially depend on my husband, it just didn't work out real well. And we had communication issues and things like that. And, you know, so my marriage was in kind of a lull. And interestingly enough, I went and had consultation with a divorce attorney, and she's like, this is pretty funny. She's like, I think what you really need is a good therapist. So, and she referred me to one. And she said, and your husband needs to go too. And I was like, okay. So we actually did the marriage counseling thing. There's a reason I'll bring that back. But so my behavior and my acting out at this point is pretty much off the rails. My kids were being watched by a nanny all the time because I didn't want to be around them when I was in an inebriated state, which is pretty much 24/7. Life had lost its meaning for me. It was like everything was in black and white, and I was either sick and tired and needing to take something else to refill just the slightest bit of normalcy. And that went on for about 2 years until some of my behaviors and actions caught up with me. And they just weren't, I just wasn't doing a lot of things that a nice lady should be doing. And my husband had finally had it. And the therapist, the marriage counselor said, the biggest problem in your marriage is that your wife's an alcoholic. And I'm like, whoa. No, I mean, okay, I made some bad choices. Maybe I haven't, you know, been, okay, the poster for great wives, but, you know, that's a little extreme. My husband agreed with her, though, and they said, you're going to rehab. And I said, really? And then I was like, okay, well, I'm kind of tired. I could use a break. I think they'd probably give me massages, and I can journal, and it's going to be really cool. So that was why I went to treatment. Yeah. It was so not a spa. I will never forget my husband. This was in Tampa, too. They're like, they had to get me out of town also. They knew that the only chance I had at getting sober was getting away from the people that I was running with at the time. And just getting me in a completely different environment where I didn't have access to anything. And so, interestingly enough, it was April 20th, which is the day after my as we call it, belly button birthday. And I think that's really cool now, but I'll get to that later, too. So I was in treatment, and I didn't think I belonged there, but I said, okay, I'll do the deal. And I had to go to a meeting every day or sometimes twice a day. And they had, I mean, I was scheduled within a second of my life. I had to be somewhere all the time, and it was like lockdown. I had no phones. You couldn't talk to members of the opposite sex. You had to read the big book. You had to give reports. You had to do all this stuff. It was like work. It was like AA school. And I hadn't totally bought into the I'm power, you know, my life is powerless over alcohol. I was still kind of, you know, not really believing it yet. And they drove us around in this big white van, affectionately or not so affectionately, called the druggie buggy. And there we go, rolling up to the meetings in the van. And, you know, so I was going to meetings. And they made you pick up a chip every single meeting you went to. So I went to a lot of speaker meetings, too. And I was hearing so many stories from other people that were so familiar. I mean, it's not even like just hearing, oh, you know, the incomprehensible demoralization, or then learning of your incomprehensible demoralization because you were in a blackout, someone had to tell you about it. You know, like, oh, I'm not the only one that happens to. Wow, that's kind of neat. You know, but it'd be someone that I wouldn't have anything in common with otherwise, you know. And so as I started hearing my story more and more, and I started reading that big book, some things started becoming really, really apparent to me. And I can also say that my mom had at one time 13 years of sobriety. she didn't have custody of me when she was sober, but at least I've seen someone in my family work a program and have some good results. Well, she also, ran off with my husband's best friend and busted up his marriage, and, you know. So there were some not-so-healthy behaviors, but she was sober. And so I knew this program could work because I really didn't think my mom could ever be sober. And so I gave it a shot. And I knew, for if nothing else, my two little boys, I had another son, by the way, in there somewhere. My sons deserved better. They deserved a mom who didn't fall asleep when she's reading them goodnight stories. And I used to always be like, good night, Moon. Good night, Mom. that's kind of sad. My son, 4-year-old, Mommy, wake up. And that's just so uncool. So for them, if nothing else, I said, I'm going to at least be open-minded. And that was what I was told, is just to be open-minded. And as I stayed in rehab for the 30 days, because my insurance company decided I was better, although the treatment center said that I needed to be there for another 3 months. So they said, okay, well, we'll let her out, but she's got to go to outpatient treatment for 3 months. So I did that. They let me out, and I was so happy to have freedom. And I said, if I ever have to do that again, I won't make it. I just will not make it. I had been so utterly broken and just humbled and stripped down to nothing that I had nowhere to go but up. I was miserable. I remember reading Heath Ledger's toxicology report somewhere around that time, thinking, God, what a lightweight. Man, all the times I've taken more stuff than that, and I still woke up. Damn it. I really didn't want to live anymore. And a friend of my husband's who's had, I guess now, double-digit sobriety, or, double-decade sobriety, gave me my first big book, and he told me, you need to come to Central, and he gave me the name of a lady who is a very, very big part of my life now, and she took me to my first meeting here, and I'm pretty sure I cried through that whole meeting. It was, it wasn't a good sight, but because I knew at that point, I was powerless. My life was completely and utterly unmanageable, and I knew that there had to be something greater than myself that could restore me to sanity, and I grappled at first with the whole spirituality religion thing, and luckily someone quickly pointed out to me that it's not a religious program, it's a spiritual program. And do you just believe that there's something out there that's bigger than you? And I was like, yeah. There's something that makes cells that divide and turn into a baby. I mean, yeah, there's something out there, and it is bigger than me, and it does pretty wondrous things. So that's all I needed to say, I do believe in something that's greater than myself that can help me not drink. And I took my time, but then I got a sponsor, and she was wonderful. And working the steps, it took me a year. I don't recommend that. You might want to get a little more proactive, but I took my time, and but I did. And then it was the fourth step where I was, dreading it. But it was so cool because I sat down with my sponsor, and I just spilled all of these horrible things that I had done. And she'd done them too, or worse. And I was like, God, I wasn't such a horrible, horrible mutant anymore. And I just, God, it was like such a load off my back. And then also, there's this whole realization of my problems were of my own making half the time. And that I actually was pretty selfish and self-centered and egotistical and driven by fear and ego and all these things. And I actually learned to see that I have a role. And most of my problems or the conflicts and things that come up in my life, a lot of times, what did I have to do with that? I couldn't use the word victim anymore. I wasn't a victim anymore. I could actually objectively say, I'm a dumbass and I kind of created this problem and that's what I get. And that's been a huge blessing in my life, because now I can look at any problem in my life and say, what's my part? And now I also have learned to make amends when I've done something wrong. After you've done it the first time, it gets a lot easier. I can say I'm sorry and get on my hands and knees and really mean it and be like, I am so sorry for doing that wrong or doing what I did. And that's also a gift, because when you have to blame other people all the time and think that you're bulletproof and that you don't do anything wrong and that you're always right, it's not the case with me. that's just one of the many, many gifts of sobriety. I would say the greatest gift is I went from being a person who I defined myself by, like, what I owned and what my career was and what I made and what Orlando Magazine was saying about me and all these really idiotic things when I was a dying, miserable, broken soul. And interestingly enough, I started coming to Central every single day. My career tanked the year I got sober. I had to declare bankruptcy the year I got sober. I had some really uncomfortable things that I had to work through that first year. But I also worked through the steps as I was working through those things, and I never drank. And I just kept coming here, and since I didn't have a job, I treated AA like my job. I came here every day at noon. I dressed up like I had somewhere to be, because I really didn't. But at least it made me feel like I had something to do and somewhere to go and people that were kind of counting on me and actually happy to see me. And it wasn't all 13th stepping either. They were actually happy to see me. and y'all are my people. And it's just a beautiful thing. By the way, tell me when it's time to wrap up.
Okay.
How much time? 10 till? Okay, cool. Thanks. Because I could talk about this forever. yeah. And so, like I said, I had a great sponsor, and interestingly enough, in my first year, after like 7 or 8 years of sobriety, she decided that she wanted to go on another path, and she went back out. And I, at that point, was like, wow, you need sponsors, actually. Like, people that have been sober for 7 or 8 years go back out. You know, I'm like, oh, that's weird. So it's kind of like being fired as a sponsee, but needless to say, I gotten to know a lot of the women in this organization, and I knew which one I wanted to sponsor me. And so she's been my sponsor now for several years, and she's a tremendous blessing in my life. She's probably crying. That's one of the things I love about her, is because when you spend so many years being numb, when you have numbed yourself so completely, and you have to start learning how to feel again, I had to teach myself how to cry. And, you know, it's like one of those things where it's like a godsend to be able to actually get out emotion and hurt instead of just bury it, and have people that I can call when the time that I'm in pain happens. I mean, life does happen. It's not all unicorns and rainbows all the time. And it's not always of our own doing, you know. It's not my fault that my 13-year-old dog, who I love more than most people, no offense, but I really love my dog, just died, you know. That was painful for me. It really was. And, you know, I apologize for the profanity, but the one thing my sponsor told me very early on, and it really made an impact, and it came from, I think, a men's group in California, is work the steps or die, motherfucker. That's all I need. Short and sweet, get to the point. That's it. Just break it on down. So, so when I have a problem, I hear those words. And like I said, sorry for the profanity, but, you know. So that's what I do. And when life gets crazy, that's what I do. And I also had this thought that sobriety was going to be boring. I thought life without drinking would not be worth living. How do you go to a party and not drink? You know, I drink to make other people more interesting. I'm like, people are so boring. God, what am I going to do with all these boring people? Good God. And so through my first year, I had some white knuckle evenings where I'm on the phone with friends and sponsors going, oh my God, I want to drink so bad. But I didn't. And by the end of that first year, and by the time I really started working the steps and trying to, you know, practice these principles and all my affairs, I no longer had a desire to drink. The obsession had been removed. And that, to me, was the first miracle. And they were always talking about these promises. And I remember at one point, like, I'm doing a deal. Where are my promises? Come on. I want my promises to come through. I want to be happy, joyous, and free. Woo! It doesn't happen like that, by the way. So, interestingly enough, though, when I quit thinking about it, when I quit, like, wanting all these things, and I just learned to be in the moment and appreciate and accept everything in my life, it all comes together so beautifully, better than I could ever plan. And I have so much fun now. Like, I go out with my friends, and I know people say to the waiter, please cut them off, because they're laughing way too loud, and they're like, it's Diet Coke. It's coming out of her nose. Because I'm laughing that hard? We are not a glum lot. And I read that early on, and but I've seen over and over that's really true. And we have a really good time in here. And, you know, humor is one of my coping mechanisms that I used my whole life, was just laughter when nothing else works. And we have a lot of fun. We really do. And that was one of the things I just didn't expect. I did not expect to have so many great friends. And interestingly enough, I also have a lot of friends who still drink that are normal. The people that, like, will have one glass of wine and then leave half of it on the table. I'm like, first of all, it's a waste of money. You're paying like $9 for a glass of wine and you only drink half of it. I mean, I used to just order the bottle because it's so much cheaper. But yeah, so I have these friends that, you know, it's interesting. I can go out with them and we have a great time. They don't care that I'm not drinking, and I don't care if they're not drinking. And, you know, but, you know, every now and then I'll run into people who are like, "You don't drink?" "No." "Oh, wow. That's crazy." Like, "Your life must be really boring." I'm like, why aren't you happy for me? That's more beer for you, dumbass. God, you know, that's how I would have thought about it. You know, because another thing too is that, you know, a lot of times people don't care if you're drinking. They don't know you're not drinking because they're so busy thinking about themselves. Like, you know, do they really care if that's club soda in my glass or gin? They don't care because they're thinking about their next drink. And, you know, that goes back to thinking, remembering and learning that I'm not the center of the universe, like I thought I was, you know. And that's what I learned from this program and doing this deal. And it's a lot of pressure not to have to be the center of the universe. And I would say the most amazing thing that's happened to me, though, is that I no longer care about the things I used to care about. And it's been the most freeing thing you can imagine. I mean, I used to care about my career. Well, now I'm just a consultant, and I work when I want to, and I make okay money, but I get to pick my kids up from school 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. I get to help them make their lunches. I take them to lacrosse practice and guitar lessons. I am so engaged in their life. We have so much fun together. It's stupid. Like, and I know they're going to be teenagers one day and be like, "Oh, you're so uncool." But I'm loving where I am right now. And the greatest gift is to be a hands-on, active mom. I don't beat my children. I don't tear them down. They don't see me stumbling and falling on my face and embarrassing them and jumping out of cars and trying to kill myself. You know, they have a pretty normalish life. And to be able to give them that is something I appreciate tremendously. And I don't care about having a career anymore, you know. I lost my big beautiful house, and we, you know, because the economy, you know, it takes its toll. I don't have a career, and so there goes my favorite beautiful lovely dream house. And so we start looking at rental houses, and I'm renting a house from somebody in the program. And that was a freaky thing. Like, talk about, you know, all these bizarre coincidences that happen. You know, the one and only rental house that I liked and wanted to rent, the realtor goes, "Oh, this lady is really tough. She's very judgmental about who she'll let rent her house." And then she's walking out of the door as we're going in to look at it. And I'm like, "Hey, I know you from Central." And now I'm renting her house. I mean, those things don't happen by coincidence. You know, like I said, the stars align. If you just do the next right thing and do it you know is right, it's all going to come together. And it always comes together in a way better than you probably had intended or imagined. And, you know, the fact that I have a very simple life and I live in the moment and I try to be a good wife and a good friend. And speaking of being a good wife, my husband and I will be celebrating our 13th anniversary on Monday. Yeah. So, yeah, that came for a short bit. He's put up a tremendous amount from me and stayed around. Because I tried to run him off. He wasn't taking it. And we've worked through things, and our life is really amazing. And I owe it all to this program and the people in this room, because it's just suggestions, and it's a program from living that you can incorporate into your life that will just somehow remove the obsession to drink. You know, it's not that complicated. Don't overthink it, but be honest, open, and willing. Those are the words I was told as I was being carted around in the druggy buggy. they stuck, and I've tried to do that. And there's no graduation. You just keep growing. You keep doing it. And I have found every year it gets better. The more I put in, the more I get out. And I think I need to wrap it up because I'm running out of time. Yeah, okay. This is kind of like trying to talk about like the history of the U.S. government in 30 minutes. Like, there's so much. I like to talk about drunken exploits and stuff like that, but I don't want to bore you with all that. There were a lot of them, and they were embarrassing. So anyhow, I'm just, like I said, I'm grateful for this program. I'm grateful that I finally got to get to the equivalent of my very only true Hollywood story, because... closest I will get. I always wanted to be famous, and I always wanted to be, you know, like, I remember when I saw the Bad News Bears when I was like, you know, 8 years old. I was like, Tatum O'Neal and I were separated at birth. She was the pretty sister, but I know that we're like kindred spirits. 30 years later, who knew? But, you know, I no longer want to be someone else. I want to be who I am, and I like who I am, and I honestly owe it all to this program and the individuals in this room who remain in my life and helped me stay sober, and I'm just grateful. Thank you.
Thank you.